Welcome to the 60th episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan, and I want to welcome first-time guest, Professor Joshua Joel Spolstra, to the show. Welcome, Professor Spolstra.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm excited to be here and chat about this topic.
Awesome. I'm very excited. So for those less familiar with Professor Spolstra, he is a professor of world religions at Piedmont College, the pastor at Downtown Community Fellowship in Clemson, South Carolina, and his dissertation was Life Preservation in Genesis and Exodus, an exegetical study of the Teva, where he earned it from Stellenbosch University in South Africa.
That's right. Yeah.
South Africa. I don't know how you pronounce South Africa. South Africa.
It was pretty close.
All right. So now, more pertinent to our conversation and what we're talking about, he also published an article in 2014 entitled The Function of the Mishte Yain in the Book of Esther. Which brings us to our topic of this episode. And for those, also, just a quick pitch, this is the second out of three episodes this month dedicated to talking about Purim. And you're also welcome to check out last spring's set of three episodes all on the topic of Purim. So I do want to talk about, Professor Spolstra, I do want to talk about, of course, the specific term of Mishteh Yayin, but I also want to talk more broadly about the function and term of Mishteh.
Yeah.
And both,
let's go.
both specifically to the Book of Esther and also more broadly within the Bible. So right. Yeah, I'm excited. So just to do a little introduction for those perhaps less familiar with this term Mishteh, which before I even bother trying to discuss it, you know, Professor Spolstra, how have you found that people translate it? Like, how do people usually translate it?
Yeah, well, usually it's translated as feast or banquet. And this is both in like lexicons and a lot of English translations, Christian English, but also like TMK and JSP or JPS. So banquet or feast, it's a lot more on kind of the full meal deal, but the emphasis isn't so much on eating as it is about drinking.
Right. I don't know about you or any of the listeners out there, but I think of feast or banquet, I think of, you know, I don't know, maybe turkey legs, you know, a whole bunch of foods. Yeah, there may be drinks out there because, you know, it's a meal after all.
Yeah.
But as you're pointing out, the word itself, Mishteh, doesn't lend itself so quickly to just thinking about a massive feast featuring food.
Yeah, right. I mean, the root from Mishteh is shata, which is to drink. And that really is what is central here. So whether it's a consortium or whatever, drinking is the main deal.
Right, right. So just to contextualize it for other people, so that's the translational piece. So we're talking, it's a drinking event of some sort. I think we can translate it as a drinking party, a drinking event, right? I think party, we'll settle on drinking party. I think that's a good one. Yes.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So of the appearances of Mishteh in the entirety of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, so there's 46 times it occurs, but nearly half of this is all concentrated in one biblical book. It appears 20 times in the Book of Esther. That's a massive amount, considering that the next closest really is the Book of Genesis, where it appears just 5 times. And then you get a few other books where it has just a few appearances, but it's a massive disproportionate amount right here situated in the Book of Esther. So it's clearly not only important for the entirety of the Bible that such a huge amount is disproportionately all settled right here, but also it sounds like it's going to be significantly important, even just for understanding the Book of Esther itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, chapter one is kind of an overture, and there we open to the biggest.
I'm gonna let your tease there hang. I do want to point out something that I loved about your article. This is a quick pitch for people to read your 2014 article. Really cool fascination with, you mentioned chapter one, but what you mentioned about chapter one in the Book of Job. That I know when I've read the Book of Job, and you start out, why is Job making sacrifices? Why is he offering? Like, what has he got to, like, okay, so people might have told a raunchy joke here or there, but what has he really got to, you know, make these sacrifices and offerings for? until I realized that the word there is a mishteh, that what's going on with Job and his family is that they're having a mishteh. They're getting together, they're drinking. And what Job is doing is offering, just in case, you know, things can happen when people get drunk. And so I found that really fascinating about your article. I appreciated that insight.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, that means
absolutely.
A lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I know you wanted to get into the Book of Esther. I saw you starting to get into the chapter one of the Book of Esther. I was thinking chapter one of Book of Job, but let's do it. So there's a lot. I mentioned 20 times. We see a lot of mishteh. And so, yeah, I'd like to kick us off. Where do we see mishteh in the book? Let's do an overview.
I mean, there's mishteh right at the beginning. In chapter one, there's the very long party, and you know, scholars and sages wonder if this is one of several hyperboles. But regardless, we have the overture to the book, and I think it is like a template by which to read and understand the other mishtas throughout. And there's there's a lot of them. When it comes into conjunction and like in a construct chain with a yayin wine, then something special is happening.
All right, so let's talk about these early mishtaot, these early drinking parties, right? So right off the bat, literally, it's right there, the first four verses, that we see King Ahasuerus, the main king of the story, throws a huge drinking party for 180 days, which is a half of a 360 day year, and we're thinking about this part of the world, and they work off of Babylonian math, and 60 is a huge number, right? So 360 is massive. This is literally a half year party to show off his wealth, right? It's literally, that's how the book opens. We are opening with a drinking party. And lest you go without drinking after that, literally the next verse is another drinking party. It's a week-long drinking party for the Shushanites, right? Folks who are in Shushan. And for some gender equality, we also get in verse 9, Queen Vashti throws her own separate drinking party for the women folk, right? Amishte Nashim. So we get into the construct there.
Yeah.
So we have like really literally off of the bat, it's hard to miss. And if you miss that in chapter one, it's, what are we even doing? It's like you're not even paying attention. Chapter one is mishteh, mishteh, mishteh. Drinking party, drinking party, drinking party. Yeah. That sets the tone.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? Right. And so, and then transitioning, actually, we go from that mishteh nashim, that women's drinking party. We actually go, the very next one is in chapter two after. So we have this transition where King Ahasuerus dispenses with Vashti and seeks out a new wife, settles upon Esther, and they actually make, in chapter 2, verse 18, they make a mishteh Esther. They make Esther's drinking party. It's in her honor. And we have, so that seems to be sort of the beginning. We have these four separate drinking parties, right? The 180-day one, the 7-day one, Vashti's, Esther's. So we have, if you are taking a shot every single time you saw the word mishteh in this book, good luck staying sober till the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
So, but then things start to get a little interesting, right? We have in chapters 5 and subsequently 7, it's a little bit different. We go from the really public, the really big, right? We have the really big 180-day huge one. We go a little bit smaller that King Ahasuerus is throwing for the Shushanites for a week, and then we have the women's one, we have the Esther's one, and all these are pretty public, all largely situated around the royal. They're like royal drinking parties, or at least royally throw.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so now what we get is this very curious mishteh in chapter 5, verses 5 through 8. This the one that Esther invites both Haman and King Ahasuerus to, and not a lot happens, actually. It's like rather uneventful. It's just and Haman gets really excited, and it's largely anticlimactic. Nothing particularly special. It happens. They drink wine. But it's a Mishte Yain. It's a Mishte Yain. But that's not that's not the only Mishte Yain, because we subsequently get it for the first 8 verses of chapter 7. Once again, Esther's throwing a Mishte Yain for King Ahasuerus as well as Haman. So it's interesting. So one thing I think was really fascinating, I don't know what you have to say on this phrase Mishte Yain. I'm very curious. But I'm going to throw this out there as just some sort of fun speculation that I don't know that it can be backed up, which is, why specify here? Like, we've had enough Mishta Oat so far. We've had enough drinking parties, and none of them were qualified by saying there were wine drinking parties. They were just drinking parties. So my speculation is that where they were situated in Persia was not necessarily wine country. They could largely have been a beer consuming culture. And for these large, huge royal gatherings, or at least large royally sponsored ones, they could have been drinking all sorts of beverages. Wine might have been up there in the mix for sure, but beer probably could have been a featured beer, a featured beverage. Who knows? Maybe they could have had other beverages as well. But here, with these two, with a much smaller crowd and clearly very honored guests, for a very special occasion, they could have had a wine drinking event. And who knows? Maybe that's why Haman got particularly excited, not just because of the exclusivity of the crowd, the particular partiers, as it were, but also specifically because it would be wine. And maybe there's a certain special sense that accrues to it, that because it was distinctly wine, it would be the finest wine in the lands.
Yeah.
I can't back that up, but that's something that's on my mind of why these ones in chapters 5 and 7 might specifically be wine drinking parties.
I like that. Yeah. It is very intentional grammatically. And so you got to wonder, like, what's going on there. And yeah, there's probably royalty, or I don't know, an elevated sense with wine, as it's typically understood. Esther chooses this setting of all settings to make her plea. I mean, like, there's something to this context, and my whole thesis is that she wants to get King Ahasuerus to this certain point of intoxication in order for her plea to land on his ears well, but not just that, for him to be provoked and strike out against the person who crosses him. And that's what drew me to this topic and to construct this thesis, because I wasn't content with anything that I was reading about, like, why the first banquet, why the first wine party was an abort mission. Some say that she, basically just chickened out, like, got nervous, like, the pressure was too high, too hot, whatever. But man, I think Esther is cunning and crafty, and she knows what she's doing. And usually, like, people not of privilege and oppressed, like, have to use any means necessary to, to scrap for their survival and to alter things according to their will. I just argue that King Ahasuerus didn't drink enough the first banquet, but then he did the second one, because as you mentioned, like, these keep getting smaller and more specified, and this is maybe just a party of three with attendants in the background,
right?
And this is unusual, and Haman's eating it up and drinking it up, and but maybe Ahasuerus is like, what's going on, like, what do you want? So just the grammar, especially in chapter 7, in the second wine party, like, this construct chain, like Mishta Yayin, is just stated many, many times. I mean, they're in the wine party, they're drinking wine at the wine party. Okay, yeah. And then he gets up from the wine party and he goes out for air and he comes back to the wine party. And I mean, it's just like very prominent in the narrative. And so more than just assertion, like here's the sequence of events that we see in the second banquet that we don't see in the first, but is actually parallel to the sequence of events in chapter one, the opening big mishta. So in chapter one, obviously Ahasuerus had drank a lot, and then he wanted to, you know, have Vashti come in wearing her crown. Maybe it's only her crown. Anyways,
it's unclear.
It's unclear. There's Jewish extra biblical writings about what might be happening. But anyways, like Vashti's like, no, I'm not entering that stag party any which way. And this, you know, this angers him. He is angered, and his wrath burns, and then he, you know, disposes of Vashti. Well, then the narrative goes on. Chapter two says that he woke up the next day from his wine and remembered what he had done to Vashti, right? And so then we need Esther to come in. Okay. But so that's, I believe, what Esther is contriving in her banquet. And it doesn't quite get off the first time, but it does the second time, because in the second time, apparently Ahasuerus does drink enough, because when he is provoked, when he's like, wait a minute, who's the guy who is threatening you and your people? Then he lashes out. He burns with anger and he is filled with rage. And then he channels that in disposing of Haman.
So how do you know that he necessarily drank more? Certainly there's a certain anger that appears in the seventh chapter, yes. But is that from necessarily quantitatively more wine being consumed in chapter seven?
I think that's there, yeah. And the clues are grammatical because of this construct chain, mishta yayin. You know, chapter five is just like, well, there was a mishta and then this other stuff happened.
It's certainly more dramatic. Chapter seven is certainly more dramatic. The drinking party scene.
More dramatic. We have the same sequence of events. And then again, Haman is disposed of, and then Ahasuerus's rage is abated. So that kind of fits. But even linking the two, and this is kind of like secondary support, but linking the two mishtas of Esther, and of course, chapters 5, 6, and 7 are the brevity of the book.
Which, by the way, I just want to point out is a cool word I learned from reading your article, this brevity, which is like where everything, like, for those less familiar with this term, where everything like flips, right? It's almost like an inversion kind of, like things.
Yep. The flipping, the turning of the tables. And I must have gotten it from somebody else. But it's so cool because let's look at Haman in the first banquet. Like he did imbibe. He did feel good because when he walks out of the first banquet that, or I keep saying banquet, the English version is just drilled into my head. When he comes. You know,
the whole point of our doing this episode is to change people's minds about how to translate this.
Yes. All right. So when Haman comes out of the mishta, the wine party, he has had a bit to drink because it says that he has tov lev. His heart is good. Like he's feeling really good. And then his sequence is kind of parroting and mirroring Ahasuerus's. So he's feeling good. Somebody crosses him, right? Like there's Mordecai still not bowing down to him. Oh, I'm so angry. He goes home. And then it's Zeresh, his wife, who's saying like, hey, channel your anger this way, dispose of him. You know, like who does that? Oh, Ahasuerus does that. So he's like, yeah, I'm going to dispose of this guy because I'm filled with wrath. He makes the execution tool, the eights, the impalement pole.
The huge gallows.
Yeah. And then he wants that satisfaction and that culmination. And this is where, you know, the tables turn, because of course it's not Mordecai who hangs on the beam. It's Haman.
Haman, right. Can I point out something also I found in chapter 7, which is really neat?
Yeah.
There is the expression Beit Mishteh, which I think is really neat. In chapter 7, verse 8, we have the king who returns from the palace garden to the Beit Mishteh Hayayin, which is this phrase, Beit Mishteh, actually only appears three times in the entirety of the Bible, Tanakh. One is Ecclesiastes, there's one somewhere in the prophets, and then, of course, here. And not that this word is significant, but I do like that there is a Beit Mishteh Yayin, that there is a house designated. Now, it might just be that was the room where they were having this particular wine drinking party, mm-hmm. but who knows? Maybe there could have been, hey, he has a palace, he's got a lot of wealth. He could have had a room designated specifically for drinking party events. It's good to be the king, right?
Yeah. It's likely.
Right. So it's the other room. Right. Because Beit Mishteh appears in an interesting context in the book of Ecclesiastes, where it talks about, is it better to go to the Beit Mishteh, the drinking house, or the Beit Avel, the morning house, which is an interesting mm-hmm. juxtaposition. But here this is the wine drinking party place or room, maybe. But yeah, so things change. You mentioned the peripety, things changed, or as you expressed it, tables have turned. Mm-hmm. And now there's a change in the entirety of the story, because now Haman, instead of being sort of on the offensive against Mordecai, is now on the defense. And also the Jews, having been on the defense, and this decree having gone out, being promulgated towards their extermination, is now it gets rescinded and so forth. And what's really fascinating is that we get to see the way in which Mishteh is used to sort of track along the peripety that's been taking place. That mm-hmm. we went from all the royal, the big stuff, it got small, got sort of condensed into this these double royal wine parties, mm-hmm. and now they're going to change. And that's we see the phrase Mishteh in its orientation change who's taking part in them. Esther gets her wishes, and Haman is on the defensive. And ultimately what happens in chapter 8, verse 17, is the Jews celebrate the king's decree that they would no longer be persecuted. And on this day that Haman had set aside for those who wanted to kill them, they would now be permitted to protect themselves. But they have a Mishteh just on the hearing, right, to celebrate that it's like a relief. It's like a big sigh of relief. That was so stressful.
Yeah.
Let's drink. You know, like we're going to have a big drinking party. And so the Jews now have their drinking party, which is now we start to see things change. Okay. So at this point in time, I want to give viewers/listeners a sneak peek at next week's episode on Medieval Rabbis' Legal Opinions on Purim Drinking, featuring Rabbi David Fried.
What's pushing a lot of the Rishonim to say it's something other than total complete drunkenness is also this sort of this interplay with the story, not to the extent of Rabbeinu Ephraim to say we reject it, but as values that need to be taken into account in interpreting what could Rava have meant.
I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek. And now back to our discussion with Professor Spolstra. So we have the final two that are drinking celebrations by the Jews. Now, in addition to what we saw in the chapter 8, so that was the Jews. Now we can see the Jews once again, actually twice again, I should say, having their drinking parties. We see them in chapter 9, verse 17, on Adar the 14th by the Jews outside of Shushan, because they have now defeated those who have come against them to seeking their destruction. They have successfully defended themselves. And now, I don't know, I guess in a sense of relief, in a sense of like, we did this, they didn't totally successfully kill us, so let's drink. And then the following day, because the Jews were still defending themselves in the capital of Shushan, so we see in verse 18 that after another day of battling, they eventually are able to keep the wannabe Jew killers at bay. So they too themselves say, we need a drink. And so they too have a Mishtet. So these are all of the descriptions of the drinking events in the Book of Esther. So basically, more broadly, if we could think about it, we have the initial ones, which are sort of more, actually, I like to think about it this way. We have two that are the big royally thrown ones, and they're big for large amounts of people. Then we have the two women's one. We have the Mishteh Nashim that Vashti throws, this women's drinking party that Vashti throws. And we also have the one that's thrown in honor of Esther for becoming the new queen. Then we have the two Mishteh Yains that Esther throws. So it's not in her honor, but she's throwing.
Yeah.
And then we have the three sort of, I don't know if they're celebratory, but they're more of like relief drinking parties, right? They're not so much happy just to drink. They're more happy that like they're still alive, right? What we saw in chapter 8, they still made it. They're still alive. In verse 9, in chapter 9, they survived, and sort of like out of a sigh of relief, probably exhaustion, both mentally, physically, emotionally, and so forth.
Oh yeah.
And so those are the descriptions, and it changes. And that peripety that we see from the ones that the wine drinking parties that Esther throws, everything changes, and it becomes less about the public stuff, and it's about the Jews surviving.
Yeah, yeah, I really like that. I've never thought about it in pairs. And yeah. I think something that's happening in chapter 9 is the legislating of this is how we should throw this thing.
Right, so that was all the description. Right. So those are all the descriptions. And then you mentioned in chapter 9, then they started to get into prescriptions. So we have in both verses 19 as well as 22 in chapter 19, they prescribed to celebrate on these days to commemorate what had occurred and that they survived, which is great. I mean, you don't have to do the fighting for your own lives, but you can still do the drinking part.
I wonder if there's like a polemicized way in this celebrating that is sort of like a jab at the, you know, at the foreign king, you know, like, oh, this is how you partied, huh? Like, well, you know what? We have all of the, putting myself into.
Well, I mean, what's in stark contrast is that the Jews are celebrating because they very nearly were on the receiving end of a genocide, right? And they, out of a sense of relief, and as we see in chapters 8 and 19, or 8 and 9, they survived. Now we can, like, we need a drink. Let's do it. Versus the earlier ones, both the 180-day and the 7-day, and for that matter, the women's drinking, there's no particular reason ascribed. It's almost as if they're just having these huge drinking parties just for the sake of them. At least what we see when the Mishteh Esther, right, the one in Esther's being chosen to be the new queen, at least that's a reason certainly for celebration. Yeah. But the earlier Mishteh, they just simply seem to be there for the sake of being there.
I know there's one theory about like maybe the Persian Empire had successfully won a series of battles, and so now they had established peace in the kingdom, and so they're celebrating that, and they can take 6 months to celebrate the peace that they've. I don't know if that's a feasible theory, then that might parallel at the very end, because now the Jews are like, no, now it's legislated, like, and we have this prescribed wine party. Because we, like, there is peace, you know, for us now, having come off of that battle.
Although I do want to point out, they are not prescribed to have wine drinking events. They're only prescribed to have drinking parties, which may also, like I said, reflect where they are living.
Yeah.
Right. So that, who knows, good. Like, you're not confined, you're not constrained to just drinking wine. If you're in a place, I mean, in Persia, they probably had a lot of beer. You could have beer if that's what you know, that's what brings joy to you.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think there is something to be said about, it's not always the Mishteh Yain, right? And the specific phrase Mishteh Yain is really concentrated around the Peripety area of the ones that Esther are throwing.
Yeah, yeah. So it may be very specific to that. Yeah, maybe she got like the better wine. Like,
likely. Once you think about every single other Mishteh, all the other drinking parties throughout the entirety of the book are done on such a mass scale with so many people. But the specific ones in chapters 5 and 7 with this very unique and elite, right? It's King, it's Haman, it's her. This is a very special crew for such a clientele or whatever. They can, yeah, you can have the finest wines in the land. Fine.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. It's a different take on the phrase Mishteh Yain within the context of the Book of Esther.
That's right. I have something new to think about. This is good.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think about what they're actually drinking. I drink the drinking quite seriously.
So. Do you think that the Talmudic statement of drink until you can't get straight, blessed be Mordecai, cursed be Haman, is do you think that that's playing off of the folly of King Ahasuerus and how he just got things twisted around? And so, like, now we should just drink until we get, all twisted around.
So I don't know how much King Ahasuerus really plays into that particular statement. So that statement is, so for those keeping score at home, as it were, was stated by Rava, a 4th century rabbi living in Persia. He was living in a suburb of the Persian capital of Ctesiphon. And he actually, it's really fascinating. So first of all, he says one is obligated to get drunk until one no longer is able to discern between blessed is Mordechai, cursed is Haman. What's fascinating about that is twofold. One is there was no pre-existing rabbinic prescription to even forget getting drunk, even to drink. So there's nothing in the Mishnah, there's nothing in early rabbinic literature about this. And he really is the one who comes along and articulates this requirement. Now, he does have a teacher who got drunk with a colleague of his. So at least we see a little bit of a precedent, but really he's the one who articulates this obligation of getting drunk. What's really fascinating is Rava is actually a really big wine drinker and perhaps one of, if not the biggest wine drinker throughout the entirety of the Babylonian Talmud. And yet he makes no mention of wine in that statement. He doesn't say you have to get drunk off of wine or even drink wine. It's just getting drunk. And I think that's, he also is keeping in mind where he's living. He's living in Sasanian Persia, where beer is the prevalent beverage of choice in the land. And in fact, he has a student named Rav Papa, who is actually the biggest beer brewer in the entirety of the Babylonian Talmud. So I think he was sensitive to perhaps the potential paucity of wine in Persia and in any other land that might not have wine as flowing as other lands. And so I think that's, for me, that's what stands out about a statement.
Okay, so it's about...
He doesn't obligate the wine. It could be anything. Okay, yeah,
it's not what you drink, it's how much to drink. So, but where is the blessed be Mordecai, cursed be Haman? Like, how does that connect, do you think?
I don't know. I think it's just really meant to there's a lot of people who've written a lot of things about that.
Okay.
there's a lot on that. And I mean, quick pitch for next week's episode. For anybody out there, you can check out next week's episode on this and the various medieval approaches to that specific aspect of the statement. I don't really know what to make a lot about that. I think it's really meant as like you get jumbled up in your mind, you've drunken a lot and things get cloudy. I don't know that there's a specific metric by which that is actually gauged. I don't know how that's actually done.
I'd like to say that I really appreciate the Hebrew Bible approach on alcohol. You know, I mean, like my reading over the whole Tanakh, taking all things in consideration, it seems to be that, there's this to drink to celebrate. Whereas like modern Western culture, like you drink to escape or to forget or because you're feeling awful. Is that the best reason to drink? But to drink to celebrate, I love that. And of course we see it, most joyously and robustly in the Book of Esther.
Yeah, I like that. That's great. That's great. All right. Well, thank you, Professor Spolstra. Is there anything you're working on or would otherwise like to share with our viewers/listeners?
Well, I am trying to expand on this topic, actually. The project's working title is Wine, Women, and the Witless King. because you see this triad as a motif here in Esther, of course, but also in Daniel 5 and the book of Judas, and even in the New Testament, Mark chapter 6, where like Salome and King Herod. And anyways, there's just always wine. There's just there's cunning and crafting women, and then there's just this doofus buffoon king, and the, you know, the kingdom gets compromised because of the subversive means and nature within the wine drinking parties.
I just want to use this as an opportunity to quickly pitch. We've done episodes on both wine in the book of Judith and wine in the book of Ben-Sirin, which wine and women can be a tough topic. So it's a quick pitch out there for anybody interested in those topics. If you haven't already listened or watched those episodes. Awesome. Okay. So, well, Professor Spolstra, thank you so much. This is really great. Thank you so much for the discussion on this term of Mishteh, and more specifically Mishteh Yayin, and more broadly about the book of Esther. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Awesome. My pleasure. Thank you. And L'chaim.
L'chaim. L'chaim.